You see a door. Above the door is written,
Thinking Rabbit. Welcome to the Doors and Dungeons Retro Gaming Podcast. I am your host, Michelle Belmont, and today we're going to talk a little bit more about the company Thinking Rabbit, who we mentioned earlier in my podcast about Sokoban. And to add to that, we have a special guest with us who's going to hopefully give a little bit of insight here and there. Welcome. Well, you know what? You can just introduce yourself.
Hey, how's it going, everybody? Name's Tom Lipschultz. You might know me online as Weirdwad.
Yes, we're going to discuss Thinking Rabbit today. So I wanted to cover a little bit more about this company because, you know, last time we talked about Sokoban, and I think Sokoban is very interesting. I'm not sure that everyone else does, but I do. And this company, you know, I have a few other little games from them and a few other little things. And the more I look at this company, the more interesting and unique they appear to be. And me and Tom have had... What's the right word? Interactions? Collisions with Thinking Rabbit on a few occasions. So I decided to bring him in and, you know, hit this head on, as it were, like a collision. First, I wanted to just give a little brief history about Thinking Rabbit and just kind of explain what they are. Thinking Rabbit is a company that was started in the early 80s, I guess somewhere around like 1982 maybe. And they are most famous, of course, for the Sokoban game, which we mentioned earlier. As I said last time, they technically still exist, although they do exist as sort of a subsidiary now of a company called Falcon Company Limited, which I guess Hiroyuki Imabayashi works for. I'm not exactly sure the relationship there, but nevertheless, they are together. And interestingly enough, Thinking Rabbit does still have a website, which you can go to and you can find out some information about their games and stuff. It's, of course, all in Japanese. And it looks like they actually have a browser-based adventure game, which you can click on, which I thought was really neat. Sokoban, like I said before, I think it's interesting. But Thinking Rabbit has a very interesting list of stuff that they have done. And so I really felt like it would just be cool to dive into that, because this is a company that almost nobody knows anything about anymore, it seems. And one of the things that I found is interesting about them is that they were actually based in Takarazuka, which, Tom, you don't know anything about Takarazuka, is that right?
I am not familiar with it offhand. It might be one of those places that once I hear more about it, I'm like, oh yeah, that place. But I don't know anything about it offhand, no.
Well, the place is not nearly as famous as the theater that it is famous for. It is famous for the Takarazuka Review, which is an all-girls theater troupe, which is very, very famous in Japan. They do like musicals and plays and stuff, and it's all women playing men and women roles. It's very, very popular, even in the West, mostly among women, but it's very, very famous. They did stuff like, I think they did a Lupin live action stage play, and I know they did an Utena stage play recently. They've done a lot of different like adaptations of famous things, and also they do a lot of like Broadway musicals, and I think they did Les Miserables recently, and stuff like that. Phantom of the Opera, that kind of thing. But it's all female, and it's very, very famous as sort of a gender-bending idol kind of thing for a lot of, you know, young, impressionable women, and older women, too.
I'm definitely not familiar with them. Yeah, that's news to me, but have sounds kind of cool. I definitely would like to look them up at some point.
Have you seen the Utena series?
I actually have never seen Utena.
Oh, okay. If you had, you would probably know more about it, just because a lot of Takarazuka's style is referenced in the anime, which is ironic in that they then, many, many years later, did a live Utena production for Takarazuka, so they basically get to reproduce themselves in a way. Anyway, it's really, really famous.
That's cool.
It's near Osaka. It's a town somewhere. I don't remember if it's in Osaka or if it's in Hyogo, but it's not too far from there. One thing that it is famous for is actually the artist Osamu Tezuka, which I'm sure you know. Yeah, I believe he was born there actually. In one of our textbooks, they talk about how one of the most formative things in his life, which this is way off topic, but nevertheless, one of the most formative things in his life is that during World War II, he had to quit school and he went to work at a munitions factory in Osaka. It was near the end of the war, and their factory was bombed, and he was in the watchtower watching for enemy planes. And amazingly, his tower did not get bombed, but the factory below did, and a lot of his friends were, you know, dying all around him. And he managed to get out of the fire tower and run away from the factory while everyone around him was just, you know, dying. I mean, he couldn't do anything to help. And apparently he ran to the river, and when he got to the river, it was just full of dead people. And he, like, freaked out and decided to walk all the way back to Takarazuka, which... it's not, like, terribly far, but, I mean, it's, like, a 20-30 minute train ride, I think. So, it's far enough. And it took him, like, a day or two to walk back. And along the way, he met this woman, because he was, like, dying of thirst and hunger. And he met this woman who gave him, like, the last of her food rations. Like, it's just, like, two rice balls and some tea. And it was, like, the last of her food. And then... he was so thankful, and he went tried to go back like a month later and found out that she'd been killed in the bombing. And so, like, this is one of the reasons why he talks so much about, like, war and the value of life and, you know, nuclear power and all that kind of stuff, is because he saw so many people dying around him in the war when he was working in Osaka. But yeah, so Takarazuka is actually very famous, and one of the other things they're famous for, just throw this out there while we're on Takarazuka, is they're one of the towns, one of the maybe six or seven towns or special wards now that allow same-sex partnerships. Several of the wards in Tokyo, I believe Osaka, the capital of Okinawa, what's it, Naha, I think, has it now.
Naha, yeah.
Sapporo has it now, and Takarazuka has it. Which is very odd, because Takarazuka is such a small place. But they've got an all-girls theater, and a lot of lesbian women go there and crush on these girls. So I guess that's a good reason to promote that. Yeah, so Thinking Rabbit is from the most unlikely of places in Japan, Takarazuka. And I wonder if that sort of creative history gives them their bizarreness, because they are a very off-the-wall kind of company, even... in fact, especially for Japanese standards. So there's a few things that I wanted to discuss here. One of them is a game that we talked about, of course, Sokoban. And I wanted to ask Tom, did you get around to playing it at all? Because I sent my MSX copy to you at one point just to, you know, see if you were interested in it or not. And I know you sent it back to me, but I didn't hear whether or not you actually got any time to play it or not.
Yes, I did. I didn't play a whole lot of it. I only popped it in once, and I played like six or seven boards, I think, something like that. It actually took quite a while, because they get pretty pretty difficult pretty quickly.
They do.
So it actually took a pretty long time for me to even get that far. I was enjoying it, but I feel like I might enjoy a more modern remake of Sokoban, simply because... it's such a basic game. The graphics are very simple. There's no music. The sound effects are not anything special.
No.
It's just very, very simple, very basic game in general. But the puzzles were good. I mean, it was certainly an engaging little puzzler.
That's what I found with it as well. The puzzles are very engaging, and the graphics are charming in a way, and the lack of sound is... It's nice if you want to just relax and veg out while you're listening to something or if you're watching something. It's something you can do in the background. But modern versions of it definitely improve on it quite a lot. Some of the, like, Super Nintendo or Game Boy even, or you know, the smartphone version. The smartphone version is really good, and it's because of it's on smartphone, it's something you can take with you in public, and the sound effects are a lot better, the graphics are a lot better. So I find that it's a more engaging in that way, while also being so simple that you can play it anywhere. So I think it definitely benefits from that.
It definitely seems like the kind of game that would be perfect for a smartphone, because it's like if you're one of those people who really enjoys like Sudoku puzzles or something.
Yes,
and you just
definitely.
You just want something else to like stimulate your brain when you're out like on a train or something. I think it's a perfect game for that kind of thing, for sure.
The only problem with that is that unfortunately, especially here in Japan, the Japanese youth are just addicted to games that have like 15,000 things going on at once. Like a puzzle game cannot just be a basic puzzle game in Japan. It has to be a puzzle game with a dragon and magic spells and combinations and crazy music and collecting items and like 500 other things all mashed together before they will pay any attention to it.
Well, we are in the age of puzzles and dragons, I suppose.
But there's a part of me that likes that likes that simplicity of a game like Sokoban, where I'm not having to freak out and panic, and I know that if I have to stop the game, I'm not going to lose something, you know.
Yeah, no, I totally get you.
I definitely do agree that it would be better on newer versions. Although, again, the charm of the old-fashioned version is, I like it, and I do love the box art. The box art is on my on the cover for the podcast of the last week's episodes. If you didn't get a chance to look at that, please do. It's cute.
It's got that very 80s charm to it, for sure. I do appreciate a lot of the box arts for games of that era were just amazing in Japan.
Yeah, they definitely were. Moving on now, we're going to talk about their adventure games. And Thinking Rabbit is apparently most known for their thinking games, which... is a good and bad, because a lot of those games didn't get translated, which means that a lot of them, especially in this early era of, you know, the home PC market, a lot of them remain largely unknown, which is kind of sad, I think, because some of them have some really good ideas, but, you know, what can you do? It's Japan from the 80s. But adventure games really was their niche for a while, and they had some that were slight hits in Japan, one of which is a game called... The Man I Love. And I don't know if you got a chance to look at this game, but it has a really bizarre art style to me. The only way I can describe it is that the characters look like they're characters from like a Ziggy cartoon. Like they're short, they're stubby, they have like really bulbous arms and bulbous gigantic noses and stuff like that. And it really looks like that kind of a cartoon, but it's apparently kind of a murder mystery kind of game. And it's very cliche, you know, your main character's a detective with a fedora and a trench coat and, you know, that kind of thing. It looks like, you know, a Ziggy cartoon version of, you know, Casablanca or the Maltese Falcon or something like that.
Okay. I did not get a chance to look at any art from that, but that sounds interesting. I do always appreciate when... like almost every game that came out, especially adventure games in the 80s and 90s, had the more traditional anime art style in one form or another. So it's always interesting to hear about ones that sort of eschewed that and went for something completely different.
And another weird thing about it is that it is a black and white game. Oh, I don't know. Maybe it's sort of a thematic thing, I think. But the MSX version of it is black and white as well, which is very interesting. I wanted to take a second here and just play, this is a PV from The Man I Love, which means promotional video. And this is the MSX version. And one of the things I find interesting about it is that it is actually in black and white on the MSX as well, which I think I might have said that already. But nevertheless, it is kind of odd for the MSX to see a game in black and white. Although, I think you said that apparently the Sharp X68000 version is not.
Yeah, I did a Google image search for it just now when you were mentioning the game, and the MSX version and the X68000 version, like the screenshot that showed up on a Google image search was identical, but the one for the X68000 was in full color, whereas the MSX one was black and white. Otherwise, the images look 100% identical, though, so that's very unusual.
So here's a promotional video, and this is all in Japanese. If you understand Japanese, you might enjoy this. If not, you'll just be like, huh, that's interesting.
ユーモラスなアメコミっぽいキャラ、ちょっぴり泣かせるエンディング、ハードボイルドなスパイスを聞かせて、アドベンチャーのシンギングラビットがあなたに送る MSX ミステリー、The Man I Love。
このスタートシーンを抜け出すのになぜか30分かかったので、もったいなくて次の画面を見せたくないそうです。でも、実際ゲームバランスは最高の出来ですよ。
What did you grab from that?
I just really like the fact that every single, like, MSX game, or really most microcomputer games, seem to have a PV recorded by that same dude and that same girl. Like, I swear, every single time I look up a game I've never heard of, I always find a 30-second promotional video with those two people, like, voicing over it. It's really weird.
If I caught it correctly, I think she was saying something about how, like, the opening is, like, 30 minutes or something like that, but don't worry about it because the rest of the game is really balanced well.
Yes, and you were correct. It does very specifically say that it goes for 30 minutes and it seems to not want to show you the next scene.
I see.
But then, yeah, so it basically is saying that the introductory scene is basically 30 minutes of mostly text on the same screen, but that it has a really good game balance once you get past that, which is weird to mention in a promotional
video.
Yeah,
right? Well, the opening screen's kind of long, but you'll enjoy it, trust us. I'm like, okay. Sure. But, yeah, so that's The Man I Love, and it's part of an adventure mystery series that they have. So I've got a game which is also in their mystery series, or at least I think it's in their mystery series, and it's one of the games I want to talk about next. It's called Casablanca Ni Isle. Basically, it's something about loving Casablanca, like loving the movie, I guess.
Is it just Casablanca Ni Isle?
Yes.
Yeah, then it's just like my love to Casablanca, basically.
Yeah, that's a good way of saying it, yeah. Apparently, part of the plot involves a character who actually really likes Casablanca, the movie. I wanted to go into Casablanca a little bit because I find this game is very special. I guess is a good word for it. This is a unique, if anything, a unique game. It is an adventure game. And me and Tom both sort of kind of have a connection to it in a way. I first found this game on the PC 88 in a what's called a softbox, which is apparently kind of a greatest hits for PC 88, which I didn't even know they had such a thing. But it's kind of, like I said, it's a Super Game Series softbox. And basically what it was is a company licensed other games for the PC 88 and put them in small packages the size of the 5 1/4 disc that were like plastic hard shells. And so you get like a small shrunken down version of the manual and that kind of thing. But it's you know, it's a budget release. And this one I found in that series. But then later on I found and bought for Tom, who has not gotten a chance to play the original actual disc version of it yet, but may in the future. But it's for the MSX computer. And I wanted to talk about this game and do a little bit of a comparison as well, because it's really different. So, again, this is an adventure game. It's a mystery game. But I thought I would do something really odd and bizarre here. I actually have both versions of the game here in my computer junk tower. I have a MSX and I have a PC-88 computer here. So I'm going to actually boot up this game in both systems. And we'll just give a sort of a as-we-go description of it. So while I'm doing that, though, Tom, tell me what your initial thoughts were of this game, because you did actually play a, a backup copy of this on your MSX?
Yeah, basically, I guess for people who don't know me too well, I am obsessed with the MSX. I got obsessed with the MSX back in 2015, and I've been collecting for it for a long time. And Michelle is a bit of an enabler for me.
Too much.
She'll go out and she'll find some pretty cool games and be like, hey, do you want this? And she mentioned at one point, hey, I found this MSX copy of Casablanca. Do you want it? I'm like, what the hell? And there's a Casablanca game? Holy crap. And like, she took a photo and sent it to me, and it just looks like Casablanca. And I'm just like, okay, this is really bizarre. I totally want this. After she bought it for me, I immediately went and found some DSK files on the internet, wrote them to blank floppy disks, and checked it out just because I couldn't wait to receive the copy of it. And it probably would have. That's the thing. I only put about 15 minutes into it, and I was kind of disappointed. It's more or less a text adventure. It's one of your typical microcomputer adventure games where you can, it's kind of like a choose your own adventure. I guess best analog for people who haven't played a lot of games like that but are familiar with like the NES library would be something like Shadowgate, but with a lot more text.
Or the Uninvited
or one of those types of games. Yeah, it's very much still images and textual descriptions, and then you get sort of a menu of options. And in this one, I think it was also a text parser, right?
It is, and that's something I want to explain here in a second.
But yeah, I did play a little chunk of it, and I have a few of these types of text parser style adventure games on the MSX. And to be honest, this one interested me less than most of them just from the first 15 minutes or so, which is not enough to really judge a game by. But yeah, it didn't really grab me. But again, as you said, if I had received the copy from you and actually looked at the materials that it came with, there's a very good chance I would have enjoyed it more, as there are quite a few of those style games that I own and like almost entirely because of the packaging.
Yeah.
There's a really great cassette game I own called Disneyland that I don't think I would enjoy at all if it weren't for that ridiculous packaging.
Yeah, that's
I love it so much.
That is some impressive packaging. So I want to go ahead and explain the packaging. So I'm holding the manual here in my hands, and then I've got the box here as well. The cover of this is really intriguing. You have an open field, okay? And in the background of this open field, there is one single tree. And then up in the clouds is a sort of a, not silhouetted, but what's the word? It's like sort of framed in and actually like merging into the clouds. Picture of Humphrey Bogart and, who is it? Is it Katharine Hepburn that was in Casablanca? I don't remember off the top of my head all of a sudden. The main characters of Casablanca, kind of in the clouds, you can see them, you know, cheek to cheek. And then in sort of the foreground, you've got, on the left, there is a man standing in a suit, and he's enveloped in a sort of light, kind of like a Star Trek, transporter kind of looking light. To the right is what looks like some sort of time machine device, and I believe it actually is a time machine kind of device. Looks kind of like a, not exactly H.G. Wells, more like a mixture between H.G. Wells and like a Dragon Ball kind of time capsule kind of thing. Ingrid Bergman, not Katharine Hepburn. Anyway, So you've got man in glowing light on the left, and you've got teleporty time travel looking machine on the right, and then in the very, very foreground, you've got a woman who is sitting with her back facing, you know, you, looking out into the field, and there's what looks like a man either on her lap lying down or dead in front of her, and you can't tell which from the cover. You can see the body lying down, but you can't tell if it's a living body or a dead body. And that's the cover. If you look at the back, you can see some of the art, and the art looks a little bit strange as well. The art style is very unique and weird. It looks a bit European. It looks kind of like a French animation or something from the 80s or 70s even. And there's a little bit about... You can see, like, there's a picture of a time machine. And you can see lots of little, like, bells and dials and things. There's a man and a woman in, you know, your typical trench coat and fedora kind of thing. And then there's pictures of a house with a fence and stuff like that. It looks a bit plain, but it's interesting because it's like, what's going on here? So... This game takes place in Chicago, or outside of Chicago, I guess, actually. And if you have the actual game manual and everything, there's a story in here. And so apparently, from what I gathered from when I read it, you get a letter from your friend. And I believe you're a girl whose name is Julie, I believe, or Jerry. Jerry Randolph. Yeah, Jerry Randolph. Okay. And... So her friend disappeared. She had this friend from high school or something that they were close to. And she got this letter from her friend that was kind of mysterious and weird and said that she should come see her and everything. But she has disappeared since then. And so you go with some friend of yours named Roy, I think, to try and figure out what happened to this girl. And so you traveled 120 miles, it says. From, what does it say? Gilesburg, Illinois? I don't know what that is or where that is.
No idea.
Yeah. But anyway, you travel to this small town and show up at this house to try and figure out what's happened. And when you get to the house, that's where the game starts. And so, I've got the game up here now on the screen. And what's interesting right away is the difference in the screens. The images are similar, but the PC-88 version is in black and blue. Not black and white, but black and blue. Whereas the MSX version is in color. And because of the MSX version's screen resolution, the text is a little bit harder to read on the MSX, but the graphics look a little bit better, which is fairly standard, I think, when it comes to them. But... One of the things that's interesting is when you start up this game, it says you're at the Elgar. I guess Elgar is like a professor or something. He's like the father or something. I don't know. You're at the front door. And then it says, and this is in Japanese, but then it says what to do in English. It says what to do. And this is where I find the game is really interesting. If you look in the manual, you have a command list, and it's not all there, but there's a good amount of what's there is because it is a text parser. But what I find interesting about it is that it is a text parser that allows you to enter text in both Japanese and English.
Oh, that is really unusual.
Yeah. So it says what to do. And you can say open. Let me do this in English. Oh, okay. Open. There we go. And says you can't do that. Okay, so knock. Knock on the door. So I actually typed knock, N-O-C-K, and now the disc is loading. And a man shows up at the door and is kind of like, what do you want? And then I can say talk, I think. Or maybe talk. Yeah, no, he says you can't do that, I guess. Because apparently this guy doesn't want to talk to you. I don't know. I think you can say leave. No, it doesn't know the word leave. Okay, exit. I wonder if it knows exit. No. Okay, return. No. Okay, back. Let's see. Try that. There we go. Okay, back works. Oh, I can't move back. Okay. Yeah, but anyway, you can use English and Japanese. So if I'm looking at the manual, one of the things that it says is you can type in English, and it has the command knock_door. But then it also has the katakana. It says romaji. It says knoku suru. So you can hit knock suru, which is really interesting. Oh, look is apparently one of the commands. Let's try that. Let's do look here. Okay. Look. And now it's going to load up. And it says that it's a professor and he's got some books under his hand. Okay. So let's see here. What else do we have? Oh, I can go south. I believe I can type S and go south. Okay, apparently not. Let's try north. No. Okay. I don't know where I'm at in location to this guy right now. So, I can go forward. Probably can't go forward because that would lead me into the house and the guy's in the way. Nah, we can't do that. And he looks mad, actually. He says, Nani o suru nda? Okay. So, he's not happy with that. Okay, so let's go back. Can I go back? It does say that the command back is recognized. No. Okay. I'm not sure why. Let's try right. Oh, right. Okay. So now we go to the side of the house. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to do the same thing on the MSX version. I'm just going to go right. And I'm going to pull this up and we're going to see what it looks like here. So it's loading the disk. Okay. And we now go to a side view. And now what's interesting here is that it looks like it's not necessarily in color so much as it is in sepia tone. Browns and that kind of thing. Now, it interestingly, the box actually shows color on the picture of the MSX version. But it's not appearing in color on this. I don't know why. But it is in sort of a sepia tone. What to do? Let's see here.
Maybe only certain parts of the game are in color.
Well, I'm actually on the screen that shows up in color on the manual. Yeah. Right? Let's type forward here. Let's see what we got. Forward. Okay. Okay, it says. So it lets me go forward.
When you were first describing the text parser and you mentioned that you were able to enter commands in English, I wasn't too impressed because that seems to be the norm, actually, for even Japanese PC titles. It seems like most of them have English language text parsers, but being able to enter in both English and Japanese is very, very unusual. I don't think I've ever heard of another game that offers both.
Yeah. Well, to me, and maybe it's just because I haven't played quite enough adventure games like this in Japan, to me, just the idea of Japanese people at that time period being able to do enough English to actually parse that is kind of impressive, because English, just unfortunately, English was just not, knowledge was just not very good at that time period.
It really is pretty common, though. I own quite a few adventure titles that have text parsers with English. For instance, Mystery House 2, I know, is 100% English only for the text parser.
But see, that's that's based on an English game, correct? It's the story's okay. Not, but the core of the game comes from a previous game that was an English game, I believe.
I'm trying to think if I have any others. I think Disneyland might be English commands, but I might be mistaken on that. It's been a while since I tested that out.
Well, I mean, there certainly are other games that do that. I know a lot, like the Wizardry and those kind of games do that a lot as well. But I think it was a time when they were really trying to figure out English more. But there are stories about how, especially when games like Wizardry and also role-playing games like Dungeons & Dragons, like the actual pen and paper ones, were coming over to Japan, in the late 70s and early 80s that they didn't know how to read it. And so they were using dictionaries and trying to like understand stuff. And it was, you know, really inadequate dictionaries because obviously the dictionaries at that time were not suited to, for that kind of information. A lot of the games at that time period, their translations were done almost on like a fan level, or companies would hire people to try and translate stuff that had no clue what they were doing. And so they would make up stuff at times. And so you would get like these sort of unlicensed or unofficial versions of like Dungeons and Dragons where the rules would be different because they had to just kind of, they looked at it and said, here's some numbers and what we think this is trying to say in English, so we'll just make it this rule. And it's like, that's not at all what the rule's supposed to be, but hey, sure. So I find the idea of being able to actually make a game like this so deeply in English, a game that didn't exist already in English, like Wizardry or something, is really impressive to me. And maybe that's also part of my experience as an English teacher. But then you've been an English teacher too, so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not saying it's not impressive. I have seen it before, but you're correct that I think most of the times when I've seen it, it has been games that existed in English originally. So that very well could be a good part of it, yeah. But either way, it is still very impressive to see, because certainly English language knowledge was not particularly high in Japan at that point in time. And I think anyone who's played games in the 8-bit era knows what English translations were like back then as well. So
Yeah.
Moving
on, this game starts out very simply. You're just kind of outside of a house trying to figure out how to get in. And you know, once you do get in, you find that there's this weird time capsule machine, and you go upstairs, and you're not really sure what it does. I think it's a time machine. I'm not 100% certain on that. I haven't played it deeply enough to figure it out as well, because my Japanese level is only so-so as far as reading goes. But anyway, you do get to the bedroom of the girl, and you find some information about her. And I think the game is one of those games that gets a lot deeper and a lot more interesting and kind of bizarre as you go. But it's even from the beginning, it looks very quirky and odd. And I found it just captivated me with its, what is this, if that's even a term. And I think the packaging really did make a difference too. Neither of them were very expensive either. I think they were like 2,000 yen each.
Yeah, you did mention that it was, that's part of the reason why I had you pick the copy up for me. It's like, wow, at that price, how can I say no to a Casablanca game?
Right. Well, even the softbox version that I have here was only 3,200 yen when it released.
Yeah, that's not bad. Although, not bad at all.
The MSX version was your standard 7,200 yen, which is much more what you would expect. But anyway, that's Casablanca. But what we begin to see is that this Thinking Rabbit company loves referencing foreign material and loves doing weird sort of cerebral kind of stuff. You can sort of see that with Sokoban because of its puzzle elements. But they get weirder and weirder as they go. So there's another one called... I can't remember the exact title of it, but it's basically a clown... It's like a circus clown murder mystery. And the idea is that there's apparently like a series of murders going on at this circus, and the clown is the suspect or something. And so it's like a detective story with a murderous clown, which, I mean, you know, you can't go wrong with that, right?
Sounds good to me.
Yeah. So that's one that I don't have a lot of information on yet. I have not been able to find it or anything yet to really try it out. But it looked, just what I've seen of like the cover art and stuff does look interesting.
I just looked up Thinking Rabbit, by the way, and apparently that game is just called A Clown Murder Case.
Okay, I thought it was something like that, yeah. I know the English translation for it is A Clown Murder Case, but...
Yeah, it's just, wow, that's pretty pretty on the nose, I guess.
I think the Japanese title has something about a circus as well, but I could be wrong.
Also, apparently Casablanca, the title is longer. It's Casablanca ni Aiwo Satsujin Sha wa Jiku o Koete.
Okay, which, yeah, I see that now. There is a subtitle on it, but is that the full title?
That's the full title, apparently. Satsujin Sha wa Jiku o Koete means the like the criminal,
yeah,
criminal like goes beyond time.
Mm.
So yeah, time traveling criminal of some kind.
Yeah, I noticed it does have the subtitle. I didn't bother trying to translate that on in myself. But it does say that. The Casablanca ni ao io is in like big letters, and then the rest is in small letters.
Yeah, that happens with a lot of games have those really long titles. I mean, even to this day, like a lot of Japanese games do that, where they have these insanely long titles.
Yeah,
I don't know why.
It's true. It gets annoying sometimes.
Also, they did a Hydlide 3 special version for
Sharp 6. Yeah, I was going to mention that, and I forgot.
That's kind of random.
So they were one of the few publishers who was doing some... They did a lot of weird random stuff. They were doing some X68000 ports of things, and that's one of the things they did was this Hydlide 3's special version, which I thought you would find that interesting since you've recently kind of gotten a little bit into the Hydlide series.
Sort of. I've at least picked up some interesting copies of Hydlide. Mm.
So, moving on, the next thing that I wanted to talk about is a little game called Jikai Shonen Metmag. And this roughly translates to Magnetic Field Boy, Metmag. And basically, this is a Famicom Disk System game. And what that means is that Thinking Rabbit was actually a part of that infamous DOG, the Disc Original Group. And as I've said before, anyone who's ever played a DOG game knows, as commonly said, it's called that for a reason. Most of the games released under the DOG title are bad. So, for anyone who doesn't know, DOG is basically a company that, a series of companies that got together, and Squaresoft basically handled all the publishing for smaller companies that couldn't really do it themselves. And so this conglomerate of smaller companies that were not necessarily, up to making games for the Famicom Disk System, got to make games for the Famicom Disk System, and the quality level shows. But nevertheless, a few interesting things were done with it. But two of the games that are released under this are some of the Sokoban games for the Famicom Disk System. I believe there were two of them. I think there, or maybe there's only one for the Sokoban Special. But also, there is a game called Jikai Shonen Metmag. And I haven't gotten a chance to play this game yet, but I'm going to very soon. But I did look up a video on it, and it looks really interesting. It's a cute little platformer kind of game. Looks like very, very like Legacy of the Wizard, you know, Dragon Slayer 4 kind of thing. But your little character dude has magnetic field like tricks and stuff that he can do. And one of the things that he can do is he can actually use certain blocks that have arrows on them as sort of like magnetic poles to repel him or push him further or make him jump really high or stuff like that. And so it's kind of a platforming puzzle game in that you need to use these blocks to try and figure out how to get through the level. And I think you can also fight some enemies and stuff too using these powers and stuff. And there's like magnetic warps that warp you around the screen. So it's kind of a puzzle platforming action kind of game. And it looks very cute, and it's for the Famicom Disk System. And like I said, I haven't gotten a chance to try it out, but I'm really interested into it. The music that from what I saw looked pretty decent. Some of the music made by Thinking Rabbit is actually pretty good, I think, which gets us to our next topic. Yes, it is time for that Famicom classic. I'm not sure if that's the word for it. Eight Eyes. Eight Eyes is a game made by Thinking Rabbit, which I forgot was made by Thinking Rabbit. And I actually did have a Japanese copy of it until recently. Apparently, I cannot find it as of today. I went looking for it in my collection and didn't see it, so I might have accidentally sold it, which means I'm going to have to buy it again, which is sad because I'm not entirely sure that it's worth buying again, and yet it's probably not that expensive, so why not?
I'm sure it's not, yeah, and that is a game that I'm also quite familiar with, as that's the only Thinking Rabbit game that I've ever owned, at least aside from when you sent me Sokoban and bought Casablanca for me. But, I mean, as far as games that I bought a long time ago, I owned the English version of Eight Eyes for the NES, which was, in fact, released here. Yeah.
Mm. That's something that I wanted to mention, was that this is a game that's been around for a very long time, and a lot of people still don't know anything about it, and yet it has been in English since those days of when it came out in, what year was that, 1988?
1988.
I think the Famicom, I mean, the American version might have been a year or two later. But this is a game that I've never known anything about until recently. And it's one of those weird things where, not recently, but in the older days, emulation was always a big thing. And, you know, now there's kind of a push away from that and so on. But emulation has always been this thing that's kind of existed. For me, it was always a way to find out about games that I never got a chance to play when I was younger and couldn't find real copies of. And you would download these ROM packs, right? And back when people, you know, really liked putting together ROM packs instead of just individually having databases. Because, you know, in the earlier days of the internet, it was kind of sketchy, you know, whether or not you were actually going to get a single file. Like, if you tried to download a file, your internet might cut out, or loading up a page with a whole bunch of links to files was just really annoying and so on. So it was a lot easier to get, like, a ROM pack somewhere. But so with these ROM packs, there were a few games that always showed up in the ROM packs that I never knew what they were, and I never sat down and played them. And one of them was like Abadox, and one of them was this game called Wanderers from Ease, and one of them was this game called Eight Eyes. And so this is three games here that I've just mentioned that I had never played and never got around to playing, even though they always showed up in these ROM packs for Nintendo or Super Nintendo that I would download. And I always just wonder what these are. And Ease is a whole other topic for a whole other time. Abadox is not a great game. I did eventually find an actual cartridge version of it, and it's not great. Eight Eyes is not really great either. But it is very, very unique. And so me and Tom are going to sit here and talk about that for a few minutes.
Okay, sounds good to me.
Eight Eyes is best described as a small Japanese company with not really the best programming skills trying to smash Castlevania and Mega Man elements together. And they had a lot of interesting ideas and not very good execution.
Yeah, I would say it's mostly Castlevania. There's not that much Mega Man in there, but I guess I see what you mean with the, you can choose the order of your stages and all that.
Yeah.
I guess that's pretty Mega Man.
The Mega Man aspects are probably the password system, the level selection, the fact that each of the bosses gives you a weapon that will help you defeat other bosses, and the fact that there's a predefined order that you should play it in order the levels in order to be able to beat the other bosses, because some bosses are actually completely invulnerable to the weapons depending on which weapon you have, so you have to be really careful. And also there's like the item power and that kind of thing. I mean, it's thematically it's definitely not like Mega Man, but in terms of like some of the mechanics, I guess you could say, of the game, it's got Mega Man elements. But one of the things that makes this game interesting is its multiplayer system. And to me, the idea of a multiplayer system in a Castlevania game is still somewhat novel, because we don't see very many games like that that use multiplayer system, especially not cooperative. So, Tom, I'll give you a second to just go in and explain the multiplayer system and how it works, because you've had, in a way, you've had more experience with it than I have.
Well, at this point, I mean, I've only had experience with you, as it happens, but you were curious to try it out.
What so. I mean by that is that my experience was playing with the main character, which is very somewhat similar to playing the game normally, whereas your
That's
experience
true.
Was different.
That is very true. See, this is, I guess, the one innovation that Eight Eyes really had gameplay-wise. If you take a look at the Venn diagram of enthusiasts of retro games and enthusiasts of falconry and find the very small chunk where those two intersect, those are the people who really should be playing Eight Eyes, because this is the only game I can think of where falconry plays a big role. Your main character has a pet falcon named Cutress, who you can control with various button commands in one player mode, but in two player mode, the second player gets to play as Cutress, while the main character is played by the first player. And Cutress plays very differently, as you would imagine a falcon would. So it is very, very odd, but kind of satisfying. It made the game considerably better than when I played it one player as a kid.
And that's a main point, because the game is really basically unplayable in single player mode, because there's so many little elements of the game that really require to use the falcon, and controlling the falcon and your main character at the same time is almost impossible.
Yeah, and also the game balance is very much based on having the falcon do kind of cleanup duty around the edges of the screen.
Definitely.
While the main character is fighting. The enemy placement in this game is absolutely obnoxious. I mean, I kind of remember just playing the two-player mode with Michelle. I kind of remember why I didn't like this game as a kid, because it really, I never beat a single stage as a kid, not even one single stage. I think I got to a boss once or twice, but that's it. And it's, yeah, I can see why now.
But in playing the multiplayer, what we found was interesting was that even playing through the internet, which we did, which was kind of an interesting experience on its own, through a NetPlay server with an emulation system, one of us in California and the other in Japan, even with that lag, we managed to beat two of the bosses and get to the third boss. The third boss is a pain in the butt, but we did manage to do that together, which without too much difficulty, which I found really interesting, because the gap between the single player mode and the two player mode is so drastically different.
Yeah, it really is. And I honestly enjoyed playing as Cutress, even though the controls are a little wonky. It still was kind of fun to be able to just kind of fly around at different levels and swoop down on enemies. And it was all about getting the exact right positioning before you go into a swoop. If you get your positioning right, you'll be able to damage the enemy without the enemy touching you. But you're also completely vulnerable for a short while after your swoop.
That was something I was going to ask, was, do you have, so I couldn't tell, because of, you know, wasn't watching you play it, obviously, but I couldn't tell, does Cutress stop if you don't press any direction, or does he kind of keep hovering in the direction that he's going?
He will continue to hover in the direction he's going, but you can actually change Cutress's direction.
Right.
In two player, which you can't do in one player. Cutress will just fly to one side of the screen and then automatically switch to the other direction until they hit the other side of the screen, which, yeah, when you're actually playing as Cutress, you can change on the fly, which is nice.
I did wonder, because I feel like the floatiness of that, there's some other games I'm thinking of where you can control, where a character is just floating around and you can kind of like push him left and push him right, but he'll keep going in those directions. And that always makes for kind of an interesting control where you're trying to sort of like battle against the control of this enemy, of this character.
Yeah. I definitely had moments where I was hitting left and right like over and over again to kind of hover in place.
Yeah, exactly. And that's always really unique.
Plus the fact that Cutress flies in a bit of a sine wave, so he's kind of bobbing up and down constantly. And his like vertical position is pretty much set, but you can sort of nudge him a little bit lower or a little bit higher in two-player mode, which in one-player mode, again, you can't do at all. Mm. Whatever vertical position you release Cutress on, Cutress remains in that vertical position until you call them back to you.
I see. So that's that. Yeah, that would be very different. So what I found of playing the main character, and I'll go a little bit more into that part in a second. What I found of playing the main character is that it's like playing Castlevania with a Belmont who has a short sword and not very good range and doesn't really know how steps work. And that was my experience with it. the hit detection for climbing up the steps is not very good, and the system for going down the steps is a little bit odd. It looks cool on the screen, but basically what happens is, if you've ever played a Castlevania game, you know that when you're up at the top of a ledge and you jump down and there's steps, you will fall through the steps and you'll just fall directly down. In this game, that does not happen. What happens is you jump, you will hit the steps, and when you, at the moment that you hit the steps, instead of continuing down, you'll start like tumbling down the steps, like down the steps. And I think if you quickly press down again at the, or down and jump, or down again at the right time, you'll then go continue on through the steps and actually drop down. But you have to kind of like double drop to get straight through the steps. Otherwise, you just kind of like stumble down the steps. And it looks neat on the screen, but it's really annoying when the boss is right there at the end of the steps just waiting for you, and you're trying so hard not to get hit by the dude. So that was fun.
I do appreciate that conceptually, though. It's like they put, like, the program, like, I guess the thing with 8Eyes is it's almost a really good game.
Yeah.
Because the graphics are good. The music is actually really good.
The music
I think.
Is nice.
The general control overall doesn't feel that bad, aside from little quirks here and there. But just the level designs are not good. And the enemy placement is obnoxious, and just seems like the little details, like the finishing touches, are missing to make it a really good game. But it's like almost there.
And that's one of the things that I found was interesting too, is that there's so many good ideas in this game, and I want to use that to sort of segue, if you will, into the story of this game. Because the story of this game is 10 times as bizarre as the actual game itself. So this game takes place in sort of a world romp, kind of like in Castlevania Bloodlines, or the Sega Genesis one, where you travel to different countries all over the world. You have, like, so let me think here. There's India, Egypt, Italy. What else was there? There was Russia.
I think Arabia.
Arabia, Spain, and maybe one or two others. And so you're globetrotting. Each level is a different place. And it actually, a lot of people compare this game more to Castlevania 2, even though it's not really exactly the same because there's not an overworld map. Some of the sub-weapons and things that you have are similar to Castlevania 2. And the whole slightly awkwardness of the control is also similar to Castlevania 2. But every game has like a mansion, just like Castlevania 2 does. Every stage is a sort of a mansion that you go into. You actually start out outside that mansion, and you have to open the door and then go in and explore that mansion and then beat that boss. And what I found was interesting about this game was that the story is just nuts. And before I forget, I do want to mention about the bosses. What we found was really hilarious, which neither of us had ever done before, was that when you beat a boss, you get this cute cutscene where you and that boss sit down and have a lovely little chat over tea, and this cute little skeleton dude comes out and very diligently brings you some tea and serves you, and then walks away and comes back to refill your tea if it gets cold. While the boss is telling you, well, you did such a great job defeating me, I'm going to give you this sword that you can use in the next castle. And it's just kind of like, it feels so quaintly charming. It's like, well, gee golly, you sure did best me in combat, you know? And it's like, what? And it doesn't mesh at all with the story, because the story is so dark and creepy and weird. And then it's like you get into the game and it's just kind of like, well, you beat me.
Well, I think the other thing worth mentioning about the story is, as you discovered, like I remember, like I said, I owned this game for the NES back in the day, and the story didn't seem that weird.
No,
but that's because it was completely changed for the English release. Yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and I'm gonna relate the English story, and then I'm going to explain the Japanese story as best as we can tell. So, the American story of this game is there was a post-apocalyptic world, okay? There was some nuclear disaster that ended the world. And so now everything's in this like post-apocalyptic society. Think something like Vampire Hunter D, where it's clearly in the far future, but everything's kind of reverted to a gothic style. Okay. And so there's these gems called the Eight Eyes, and each one of these gems was formed in a nuclear explosions that ruined the world, and they all have like massive nuclear power. And there was this great king who rebuilt the world after the post-apocalyptic disaster and kind of brought things back to a little bit of an okayness, right? And so the dukes under the control of these eight dukes decided, we're going to run things ourselves. And so each one of them stole one of the Eight Eyes and took the king and kidnapped him and banished him to another world. And so your job is to go and defeat all eight of the dukes and reclaim these Eight Eyes that are gems/nuclear powerhouses. And then you take them to the Temple of Ruth, which...
House of Ruth, I believe it was.
Well, I believe the English version actually calls it the Temple of Ruth.
Oh, maybe. I don't remember.
From what I looked up, I think it does. I could be wrong on that, but... I believe that the English version calls it the Temple of Ruth, where you have to fight Ruth, who the game doesn't really, as far as I know, doesn't really explain what her deal is. But you fight her, and if you fight her and defeat her, then you move to the final stage where you actually have to put all of the jewels into this statue thing in the correct order so that you don't blow everything up. And then the king will get resummoned from the alternate dimension that he was banished to, and everything's good. Okay, that's the story, basically, of the American version of the game. And that's, on its own, it's a fairly... I mean, it's kind of similar to some of the stuff that was done at the time, like Crystallis or stuff like that, but it's still on its own. It's fairly unique. It's not amazingly unique, but it's fairly out there. The Japanese version... Whoo! So... A combination of Google Translate and our own translation skills and some kanji lookup and dictionaries and stuff have allowed us to sort of put together a semblance of the story of this game. But the story of this game, as written in the instruction manual, is so bizarre and weirdly written that we're not even completely sure that we've got this all right.
Yeah, I was kind of like glazing over just trying to make sense of it last night.
So, here's what I have gleaned from it. Okay, it starts out by telling you that it's the 19th century and the Balkan mountain ranges is on fire, like politically, okay? And the seemingly failing state of the Ottoman Empire suddenly is under attack and there's only one thing that can protect it. And it's the power of the Eight Eyes, which are these jewels or something, right? From like Muslim lore or something, I don't know. It seems to suggest that they're, from what I could tell, it seems to suggest that it's supposedly some sort of like Muslim folklore thing. I'm not sure if it actually is really, but it seems to suggest that. Okay, so like that's the only thing that can save the Ottoman Empire. So the Ottoman Empire is under the protectorate of the British Empire, and so the British Empire, in order to stop a war from happening, send these researchers from the British Museum to this archaeological site where they find the Eight Eyes. And they uncover them. And it's like, oh, we found this ancient relic from mythology. We can now use them. And then, I don't know, like a message gets sent or something. I wasn't exactly sure on this part. But something happens and all of these researchers disappear. And then somebody goes there and finds all of them with their heads removed and their like entrails cut asunder, like their stomachs cut open and everything. What it suggests is that this gang of thieves led by the Satan worshipping Ruth Galdi, I think her name was, has performed some ritual ceremony killing of these British researchers from the museum and stolen the Eight Eyes with the intention of summoning Satan. Okay. So, there's some bit that we don't understand, and then it says that using these different swords and his trusty falcon cutlass, the descendant of James Bond, whose name is Julian James Bond, a part of some British organization that would later become MI5, is sent out to reclaim the Eight Eyes and defeat the evil Ruth, put them back together, and save the world so that the Austrian Empire doesn't fall apart and end up starting a world war. What?
Yep. Yeah, in the English version, your main character's name is Orin, O-R-I-N.
Which is very odd and plain sounding.
And it's kind of weird that they came up with that name, too. It's like, I kind of wonder where they got that name from. It's kind of bizarre.
In the 80s and 90s, they just made stuff up.
Yeah, I guess so. But yeah, in the Japanese version of the game, which is what we played together, indeed, your status bar doesn't show Orin and Cutress life bars. It shows Bond and Cutress.
I think you thought that meant like Bond, like your bond with Cutress.
With Cutress, yeah. So it didn't process at first. Like, oh, that's not your bond with the bird. It's literally Bond, James Bond.
Julian, like, holy James crap. Bond. Could you imagine if Sean Connery had to do that? He was like, Bond, James Bond, Julian James Bond, and this is my Falcon, Cutress. I think I'd watch that movie. It'd be like a mixture of what's that movie he made where he was in like the orange tights thing?
Oh, you're talking Zardoz.
Zardoz, yeah. A mixture of Zardoz and James Bond. That's what Eight Eyes. That's probably what happened. The team probably watched a marathon one night. Like after some Inkai or something, like Nijikai, they got really, really drunk and said, let's marathon James Bond and Zardoz. And then the next day they said, we're going to make this game called Eight Eyes. And we're going to give him a Falcon. And it's going to be great.
Yeah, it is. It is definitely like when you sent me that story summary, like your take on it originally, I was just reading it. I was like, okay, Eight Eyes is way more like bizarre and badass than I ever assumed it would be.
And I think that's kind of a shame that didn't translate to the American version of it, because it wouldn't have made the game any better to play, but it would have made it more infamous, I think.
I think you're probably right. I also think more than likely they just couldn't get the rights to the James Bond name, I'm guessing.
Yeah, that or they probably couldn't get any of the religious stuff past the censors at Nintendo. Especially
yeah,
all
that is
the
also
demon worship
point.
And all that kind of stuff.
That's true. Satan worshiper as your main villain is probably not going to fly in the 80s.
No, nor is James Bond.
Also, the Muslim lore and everything, I'm assuming they probably wanted to cut out too. Yeah, there's a lot of reasons why it probably got changed here, but it is still a shame.
So, yes, Eight Eyes is a very bizarre game that I think anyone should play once multiplayer. I don't recommend playing it single player. I believe Spain is the first level you should try. Definitely go online and look up some guides and maps. That will help you a lot because the items are really important and the order of the levels is really important.
Yep. If you do end up playing the game and you want to just sample all the levels too, Italy has the best music.
That's
love
true.
The Italy theme.
That is, I guess, the end of our sort of bizarre history of Thinking Rabbit, a company which somewhat sort of still exists, making quirky little games, and they've never really hit the big time, never really hit the spotlight, but you know, I would really, really love to get the chance to interview the creator of this company. If anyone out there knows him or knows a way of getting a hold of him, feel free to let me know, because I think he sounds like he would be a very interesting guy to talk to.
I would agree with that I would love to hear that kind of interview. I'd love to see what he would have to say.
And it's surprising too, a lot of these early PC programmers will and developers will talk to you, because a lot of them feel sadly forgotten. They feel like people don't know their games anymore and nobody cares. So when someone does, especially someone from an English-speaking country, comes up to them and says, hey, you know, you made these games that are really interesting and unique, and I want to talk to them, and they're like, they're just thrilled that someone even remembers their game exists. Because Japan just kind of forgets so quickly when it comes to stuff like games. And I think recently the shift towards retro gaming has changed that in Japan. But for a good 20 years, there was just nobody cared. And Japan just moves on so quickly when it comes to the game. So a lot of these little companies like Thinking Rabbits just go unnoticed. And it's really sad, because they're, even if they're not doing the best work, they're trying to do something different. And that's one thing that I think should always, always be rewarded and praised in Japanese culture when someone's trying really hard to do something different.
Yeah, I totally agree. And there are quite a few little companies that I've discovered since I started playing MSX games in particular that I would love to learn more about and hear from. And as you said, I think the people who started those companies are very likely to want to talk about them because they don't really get a lot of attention. And even slightly larger companies, I know recently there have been a couple interviews with Moo Nitani from Compile. And I mean, Compile is a pretty big name. Moo Nitani is a guy whose name has been in some huge games, the Puyo series and all that. But at the same time, it seemed like people really weren't talking about him or to him for a very long time. And only recently has he been conducting a lot more interviews and such.
I think that's one of the reasons why I decided to do this podcast, is to take my knowledge and take my experience and take these computers that I've got in front of me and do something with it. So I want to now thank you, Tom Lipschultz, for being on here and helping me talk about this interesting little company and for sitting down with 8Eyes with me.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for giving me a new appreciation for 8Eyes as well, because I basically dismissed that as more or less a kusoge a long time ago. So I'm glad I got to now see it as not quite a kusoge.
Not quite kusoge. That's a good word for it. This has been Michelle Belmont and
Tom Lipschultz.
And if you like Doors and Dungeons, please follow it on Twitter. It's at DoorDun Podcast. That's Door, D-U-N, Podcast. And of course, you can also find it at doorsanddungeons.com. I hope you've enjoyed talking about Thinking Rabbit. I'll see you next time. Goodbye.